The prodigal quarterback returns to Green Bay. Last month, Brett Favre, now quarterback for the Minnesota Vikings, defeated his former Packer teammates on Viking turf in a spectacular game. Today, the two teams meet again, this time at Green Bay's legendary Lambeau Field. It won't be pretty for the 40-year-old quarterback. Patty Murray of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
Number 4, Brett Favre, wore Green Bay Packer green and gold for 16 years. Now he's crossed state lines and is wearing Minnesota Vikings purple. The teams have already met this season, and the Vikings won by 7 points. That was at the Minneapolis Metrodome. Today's game is in Green Bay at Lambeau Field. It's a weird sensation for longtime Packer fans like Bob Green, who traveled here from Pennsylvania to come to today's game.
I think it's going to be more emotional for Brett than what he's letting on. I think it's going to be emotional for everybody. It's a homecoming.
The Packers have other rivals in the league, but the Vikings are now considered the team's nemesis. They're both in the NFC North, and they're nearly tied for division title. The fact that Brett Favre was once the soul of the Packers makes this a most unusual game. Tony Walter writes for the Green Bay Press Gazette and says Midwest Nice may go out the window today.
Oh, we'll hear booing. There's so much attention, so much drama. It's really off the charts.
Part of that drama is because of Favre's long winning history with the Green Bay Packers. As a Packer, he became the NFL's only three-time MVP, taking the team to 2 Super Bowls and bringing home 1 championship. But to some fans, that's ancient history.
I'll boo as loud as I can. Everybody in my section will, because we're all Packer fans.
Marty Leonard owns a neighborhood bar called Lenny's Tap. He's wearing a green and gold t-shirt with a likeness of Favre in a tri-cornered hat with the Trattorius logo, Benedict Brett. He's selling another shirt that claims, "We'll never forget you, Brent." Get it? His name is Brett. Leonard will be in the stands at Lambeau Field today. He says Favre's a big boy and can take the booing.
I boo the Bears. I boo Detroit. I boo whoever the Packers are playing. Nothing obnoxious, but good-heartedly having fun.
Good-hearted fun was what the mayor of Green Bay was after when he solicited ideas for ways to welcome Brett Favre back to town. One bit of vandalism expressed some fans' unhappiness with Favre. Near the stadium, someone crossed out the P on a street sign that had said, "Brett Favre Pass." For NPR News, I'm Patty Murray in Green Bay.
This is NPR News. Murray Fisher had a dream. Take the 600 miles of New York City's coastlines, all that water surrounding it. 4 of the 5 boroughs are actually built on islands. Then start a maritime high school that would teach inner-city kids about their watery world, everything from boat building and ocean ecology to oyster growing.
On the waterfront in one of the most protected and accessible coves in all of New York City.
Next year, the Urban Assembly New York Harbor School will open its doors on Governor's Island, a tree-covered 170 acres sold to the Dutch for 2 axes and a necklace, yards off the coast of southern Manhattan. But before we can get there, let's visit the Harbor School's current location, Bushwick, in the heart of Brooklyn.
Donovan! Perez! Please come to school at the present time!
Inside the Bushwick High Building is where the Department of Education put the Harbor School in 2003. 400 mostly black and Latino kids who used to know nothing about maritime New York now ride the subways for hours to get to waterways only a couple miles distant. Today, they're off to the Hudson River.
Okay, guys, it is time to get going. Follow me down to the first floor. Push in your chairs, please.
At the Harbor School, every kid wears a school t-shirt and learns about fish, tides, oystering, water quality. Its urban environment meets natural world. Tanks burble with classroom-grown tilapia. Brendan Malone's room is big enough to build wooden boats called prams. He's the marine technology teacher.
I was born in New York City, but I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And I attended the Sound School in New Haven when it was just opening, which was a maritime-based high school. Basically, here what we're giving them is an introduction to the knowledge and the skills that they would need to enter a maritime career.
So in many ways, you're teaching them the where you were taught yourself.
A lot of similarities. The reason, basically, the reason I became a teacher was because in high school, I got the skills that I needed to support my family, pay my way through college, and so just trying to pass on that knowledge to the next generation.
We're in Bushwick. How far away is the river? It's
Well, we're about 1.5 miles from the end of English Kill, which is a little offshoot from Newtown Creek, which is about the closest that we are to water. But if you could find a place further from any major New York City water body, this is it.
Before the Harbor School, the dropout rate in Bushwick was dismal. The Harbor School has improved that, graduating seniors in 07 and 08, and sending a handful on to marine specialties in college. That's the path that inspires 14-year-old freshman Daniel Bowen.
I want to get all types of degrees in marine biology, technology, anything marine. I love it. I try to do as many things as I can do, like scuba diving and rowing. I mostly like being in the water. That's my favorite place. Feel more at home there.
Like I said, wait to hear your name.
And of course, to be on the water, you sometimes have to get in it. And fewer than one in five of these kids could swim before coming here.
We had our advanced scuba diving class was going scuba diving in Jamaica Bay a few weeks ago, and they sent me a picture of seahorses that they had taken underwater in Jamaica Bay to my phone, which was pretty amazing. You know, it turns out New York Harbor is full of seahorses.
Assistant Principal Jennifer Ostro remembers taking the kids to Governor's Island and how they fell in love with the proximity to the water.
They spontaneously started talking about how great it would be if they could go to school out here because they wouldn't have to worry about the colors that they were wearing or flagging, because in Bushwick, if you wear the wrong colors and the gang that you're not a member of, you'll become a victim of violence. And so it made me realize that students would be able to let down their armor in a way out on Governor's Island that they couldn't do here. Mm-hmm. And being able to let down your armor really opens you up for learning.
In 2003, the federal government, which had used the island for everything from a Civil War fort to a longtime Coast Guard base, sold the island back to New York State and the city for a token dollar. The island's current regeneration began and blossoms in summer. Every developer in New York wanted in on the 19th century buildings, but Murray Fisher wanted space for his school. Fisher, 33, had worked for the conservation groups the Hudson River Keepers and the Waterkeeper Alliance, exploring estuaries around the world.
I was from Virginia, had nothing to do with the Hudson River, didn't know the Hudson River, and I fell in love with the Hudson River. And every day I would be out working with scientists on the water, working with fish, and every night I would pore over books about the Hudson River and read everything, every article I could about it. I became obsessed with the Hudson River.
You think?
In my high school, I was always having to separate the things I was interested in doing outside with my studies. You know, skip school to go fishing. Why not? Why shouldn't fishing be part of school? And so I remember thinking this should be a school.
We leave the Battery Maritime Building for the 7-minute ferry ride to the island. New York became New York because of its harbors. Once, these coves were blanketed with hundreds of miles of natural oyster reef. Now, they've been hardened with concrete.
And yet, this is still a rich estuary. There's still 206 species of fish. And so that's one of the amazing feats of the harbors, have such a built environment with such a heavy human presence, such historical pollution problems, but yet the harbor has survived, the estuary has survived. And when we go look at these oysters that we're growing in a floating upwelling system under that dock, you'll see that the oysters are growing faster and with lower mortality than they do at some commercial farms nearby. So the harbor is amazing conditions for trying to restore the oyster back into the harbor.
Murray Fisher leads us to a little man-made cove on Buttermilk Channel between Brooklyn and Governor's Island. Floating in the water is a wooden oyster tank called a flopsy, which stands for a floating upwelling system that mimics a reef.
I'm going to hop down and show you that. Most adult oysters that you would see in a restaurant are 1 to 2 years old, about, you know, 4 or 5 inches wide. These oysters can't be eaten, and probably for the next 50 years won't be eaten.
So we're right down here at the very southern tip of Governor's Island on this gorgeous fall day, looking out at the New York Harbor all the way from Buttermilk Channel, which separates Governor's Island from Brooklyn. and then rotating west, the Verrazano Bridge over the narrows that lead out to the Atlantic Ocean. And then I can see Staten Island and the Gothels Bridge connecting Staten Island to New Jersey. And then, of course, at the end of this panoramic view, the Statue of Liberty. Now, after a $34 million renovation, the Harbor School will be in historic Leggett Hall at the Island Center.
We are thrilled to have our kids here at the school, and they come out and they're so excited, and we've brought the parents to see it. It is going to be a gorgeous spot.
Well, we're right here under this whole laneway of trees, and really, this is an absolutely pastoral setting, and we are just across the water from New York City. Ah, I hear a boat.
Exactly. That reminds you that we are on an island, always on a boat schedule. What we're looking at now is the front of the building. This over to the right is going to be a basketball court, and over to the left is going to be a garden. On the far left on the bottom is a whole marine science lab, what will be for introductory marine science courses for 9th and 10th graders. And then on the right will be marine technology labs. And then just south of us is going to be the park. So there'll be a 40-acre park. So the park will be the backyard. You saw that the harbor is the front yard. It really couldn't be a better educational spot.
So how does it feel? This was your vision and your dream to use this place. How does it feel to see this actually coming together?
It's a bit terrifying because there are a lot of people, from taxpayers all the way up to politicians and donors, who've put a lot of time and energy into this. And frankly, as much as the Harbor School has gotten pressed because of the unique and unusual things we're doing in Bushwick, there's going to be a lot more of an eye on what we're doing here, and so we're going to need to be better than ever.
And it all began in one of the densest, grittiest parts of Brooklyn, at Bushwick High.
I remember showing up all fresh-faced and excited, walking into the Bushwick front door, and I told a security guard who looked like she'd been around for a while, I said, "Hey, we're the Harbor School. We're coming out here next year." And she looked me up and down and said, "There ain't no harbor in Bushwick, sweetie."
Now, the hope is that students from all five boroughs will be going to school on Governor's Island, walking under the canopies of London plane trees, gazing back at magnificent views of New York. And instead of city streets, all around them will be the vast wilderness of water. Our story was produced by Elaine Heinzman and edited by Tony Marcano. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Leanne Hansen returns next week. I'm Jackie Leiden. Just when you thought it was safe to go back in the kitchen after a summer of French cooking, out comes a 5-pound tome on the whole darn subject. It's called I Know How to Cook. Clotilde Ducillier, a young Parisian who writes her own food blog, helped translate the book into English. We want to warn you, if you're thinking about Thanksgiving recipes, some of these are not for the squeamish. Clotilde, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Would you please tell us about this rather astonishing book? We weighed it. It's actually 5 pounds, 5 ounces. And I said, gosh, that's more than I weighed when I was born.
That's a great point of reference. So it's a book that was first published in France in 1932. And it was written by a then young home economics teacher named Ginette Mathieu. And it was a book that was meant to accompany the young bride throughout her cooking life.
Clotilde, you know, of course, this summer was the movie Julie and Julia, and it turned Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking into a national bestseller. How would you compare Je sais cuisiner, which translates to I know how to cook, with Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Julia Child's book?
The major difference is in the approach. Ginette Mathieu was a home economics teacher, so she was teaching home cooking to home cooks, whereas Julia Child was taught at the Cordon Bleu, which taught her the professional approach, and she was really trying to translate professional-style recipes for the home cook. So she did simplify things a little bit, but the resulting recipes remain the chef's way of doing things.
We thought we'd take a look at the two books and compare a recipe for ratatouille, the eggplant dish, Both of them have about the same number of ingredients. Child adds parsley, but your cookbook uses less than 50 words for the directions, and she uses about 320.
I think that's a good summary of the difference between the two. I think that Jeanette Mathieu's book, you look at the recipe and you feel like you can do this because the instructions are simple and the Julia Child way of doing things is a lot more precise and detailed. So I think they both have their strong points.
When I think of French cooking, I confess that I think often of things like cassoulet or sole meunière or mousse au chocolat, and you've got some things in here that I think might surprise people. 15 recipes with aspic, 14 for liver, 11 for rabbit, 10 for kidneys, 6 each for tripe and tongue, 5 for heart and sweetbreads, 3 each for eel, sheep's feet and brain, and 1 for woodcock.
I should note that these are all figures out of 1,400 recipes, but it is very much a book that's meant to use as a reference book for the cook. So in the event that you find sweetbreads or heart, Jeanette Mathieu's book is probably the only one on your shelf that will give you some indication of what to do with it.
Well, it sounds like a book that is a classic and that people did eat those things at that time. And I'm sure in some parts of France still enjoy these delicacies very much. I mean, you've included it. Are people still eating this in France?
They are. I think it's very much a matter of opportunity. I mean, a French person living in Paris is not going to find game, but they might have the opportunity to stay at a friend's place in the countryside and some guy in the village will have hunted and said, would you like one of those birds? And, you know, you're not going to turn that down. So you would pull out the Jeanette Mathieu and any type of ingredient that you would want to work with, she will have guidance to offer.
There's directions here for cleaning a rabbit, and it's very simple. It says, place the rabbit on its back, make a cut from top to bottom, separate the back legs by inserting the knife at the bottom of the saddle, remove the intestines. And I was thinking, would a French home cook understand those directions?
I think a French home cook would probably buy the rabbit from the butchers already cleaned. I think a book that has been published in 1932 is bound to have a few antics, things that are charming in that they remind one of earlier times when you would actually empty your own rabbit. Whether that's charming to you or not, I'll let you decide. But I just find that it's a good reminder of how people used to cook from a historical point of view.
You've got some very lovely recipes on your blog, chocolate and zucchini. Are any of them from this book?
I have not published any recipes from the book on chocolate and zucchini, but I have been cooking from the book. I actually hosted a dinner party for my friends last weekend that was all cooked from the book, that was fun.
Would you share the menu with us?
I started with gougères, which are the cheese puffs. Mm-hmm. And then there was a rolled lamb shoulder called lamb shoulder provençal. And it's a very easy dish. And I find the rolling and the tying with string just a fun step. It kind of makes you feel like you're a real cook. And so I served this with mashed potatoes and roasted tomatoes. And then for dessert, we had the light chocolate mousse. It's a chocolate mousse that's only made with egg whites. No cream, no butter, no egg yolks. But
practically a diet dish.
Exactly.
Just in time for Thanksgiving. Clotilde Dusselier, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, and you've made our mouths water thinking about I Know How to Cook.
Thank you very much for having me.
Clotilde Dusselier is a Parisian blogger who's translated the French cookbook Je sais cuisiner. And you can find the recipes on our website, npr.org.
After the birth of his son, the novelist Jonathan Safran Foer started asking questions about food.
I simply wanted to know, for myself and my family, what meat is. I wanted to know as concretely as possible. Where does it come from? How is it produced? How are animals treated, and to what extent does that matter? What are the economic, social, and environmental effects of eating animals? My personal quest didn't stay that way for long. Through my efforts as a parent, I came face to face with realities that as a citizen I couldn't ignore, and as a writer I couldn't keep to myself.
That's Jonathan Safran Foer reading from his new book, Eating Animals. Now, if you think it's an anti-meat screed or just an impassioned case for vegetarianism, it isn't. though the publication of the book has already irritated the meat and poultry industry and prompted actress Natalie Portman to declare herself a vegan. Jonathan Safran Foer is also the author of the acclaimed novel Everything is Illuminated, and he joins me from our New York studios. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
How important was meat in your life, in sort of the cultural life that you were a part of as a kid?
I would say meat had considerable importance, and in different ways. I loved the way it tasted. I loved the way it smelled. I continue to love the way it smells. And I'm pretty sure if I were to eat it again, I would love the way it tasted. Meat also had a real cultural value in my family and my upbringing. It was how we celebrated the 4th of July. It was how we celebrated Thanksgiving. And I looked forward to that, and I loved it. And my ideas about Thanksgiving, it's very, very hard to extricate that turkey from my ideas about Thanksgiving.
Well, what do you do on Thanksgiving now?
I have all those great foods that we used to have just without a turkey. The point of Thanksgiving is not to be rigid. It's not to follow somebody else's idea of what Thanksgiving is. It's to bring family together, celebrate together, feel grateful together, and transmit values from one generation to the next. Whether or not there's chicken stock in the gravy has nothing to do with those things I just said. Having a conversation about what we believe in, that to me has everything to do with Thanksgiving.
I want to ask you about the research you did, because you did visit several farms over the course of working on this book.
I would challenge any listener of this program to visit the kind of farm that raises more than 99% of the animals that become our food. It is impossible.
And you actually tried to visit a plant that supplies meat to Tyson's, and Tyson's never replied.
Well, Tyson's, there's no need to single them out. I mean, I sent dozens and dozens of letters to all of the major, you know, agribusiness corporations asking to visit their farms. You know, if I wrote a letter to the producer of my son's apple juice and I said, you know, I've been feeding this stuff to my son every day. I'm kind of curious. Where does it come from? How is it made? I'd be able to go see the orchard. If I wanted to know about the bagels I feed my son for breakfast, the guys in the deli would let me around the other side of the counter. They'd show me the ovens. They showed me their ingredients. Why is this the great exception? And what does it say? What does it say that there's an entire industry that is set up that asks us to give them money, asks us to ingest in our bodies and feed to our children a product whose production they won't let us see?
You visited a place called the Good Shepherd Turkey Ranch, and you profile a man named Frank Rees, the owner. And you describe this ranch as an example of a place where ethical meat is produced. The question I have about this place is that his meat isn't necessarily affordable for many Americans. It can cost 5 to 7 times the price of, you know, say, a rotisserie chicken at the supermarket. So what do you say to people who make the argument there's a little bit of elitism here?
Well, you referred to the kind of meat that you would buy in the supermarket, and factory farms are happily tell this a similar story, that it's cheap and that Frank's meat is expensive. It's not true. I mean, it's true if you're only looking at the price at the cash register. Factory farming has externalized all of their costs. Who do you think pays? If factory farming is, if animal agriculture is the number one cause of global warming, who pays for that? You think we don't pay for it? You think they're going to ultimately pay for it? Who pays for the decimation of land value across America, which has been a very direct effect of factory farming? Who pays for the water pollution? Who pays for the air pollution? And by the way, who pays for the cost of the human health costs?
Most people going to the supermarket looking to make an affordable, relatively healthy dinner for their families are not going to be thinking about land values and about global warming at that point. I mean, can you blame them?
I mean, clearly what has to happen is people have to eat less meat. Americans have been convinced of a diet that is, frankly, unnatural and not what our parents ate, not what our grandparents ate.
I mean, they ate meat.
Americans now eat 150 times as much chicken as they did 80 years ago. When, you know, factory farms talk about feeding the world, they're not talking about feeding hungry people. They're talking about producing incredibly cheap meat and finding wider and wider audiences who are willing to eat more and more and more of it.
You make it clear, right, from the outset that you're not judging the decisions other people make, right? I mean, if people choose to eat meat, you're not judging them.
No.
Or are you, in a sense? I mean, because you argue that eating meat is the single worst thing that a person can do to the environment.
That is a well-established fact. I, in my own life, do all kinds of things that are bad for the environment, and I am a terrible hypocrite in all kinds of ways. And furthermore, I'm not altogether sure what I think about a lot of these issues when it boils right down to it. I do think that there are some baseline things that we should all agree on. the most important being that eating meat matters. It's the number one cause of global warming. The UN and Pew commissions have said that it is among the top two or three causes of every significant environmental problem, locally and globally, air pollution, water pollution. So if this is the most important way that we interact with the environment, if it's the most important way that we interact with animals, then our decisions when we go to a restaurant, what to order, when we go to a supermarket, what to buy, these decisions aren't passing. They're not, they can't be casual. You know, what we choose to eat when ordering in a restaurant, what we choose to buy at a supermarket is, frankly, the most important decision, or at least one of the very most important decisions we'll make all day.
Jonathan Safran Foer's new book is called Eating Animals. He spoke with us from New York. Jonathan Safran Foer, thanks very much.
Thank you.